This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
104 years ago this month, some 400 miners and their families were at a Christmas Eve celebration in Calumet in the Upper Peninsula. 73 men, women, and children would not live to see Christmas Day. We know this tragedy is the Italian Hall disaster, also known as the 1913 massacre, born out of the depths of a long and bitter miners' strike. Historian Troy Henderson of the Michigan History Center is here with us, as is Steve Leto, who's an attorney and author of Death's Door, the Truth Behind Michigan's Largest Mass Murder. It's a pleasure to have both of you with us today.
Thank you.
It's good to be here.
Troy, Calumet is in the Keweenaw Peninsula, copper country. 1913 was a bitter, bitter year in the mines. Tell us about this strike.
Yeah, the Keweenaw Peninsula is well known for copper mining specifically, and the industry was booming in the early 1900s. The copper companies were big, they employed thousands of miners, they had a lot of capital and a lot of community control. Like on the nearby iron ranges, among the ranks of miners were thousands of immigrants from varying backgrounds. In 1913 specifically, a strike took place on the Keweenaw Peninsula. And that was organized by the Western Federation of Miners. And they were spurred a little bit by some success in organizing miners out west. And the union sought to gain a foothold in Michigan's copper mines. And they slowly gained some influence. And in 1913, pro-union numbers swelled with, among other things, the company's introduction to implement the single-man drill in the mines. And there was an array of other issues, too. July of 1913 marked the beginning of a lengthy strike in the Keweenaw. The Western Federation of Miners went on strike, and for a time, the mines, principally the Calumet and Hecla mine, actually shut down, stopped producing. Over the summer and into the fall, the strike disrupted a community. It was an emotionally charged time. It was divisive. It was violent. The communities were being torn apart, and people were forced to choose sides in this conflict.
Steve, the managers and the owners of the Calumet and Hecla mine really mobilized, didn't they?
Back then, it was considered good business to not negotiate. So the mine management absolutely steadfastly refused to even talk to the union. They wouldn't recognize that the union existed. And in fact, they openly fought the union by bringing in strike breakers. They actually brought in people who were specialists in disrupting strikes. These are people who would come in, you know, get their hands dirty, actually going down and disrupting strike activities. If the strikers were marching someplace, these guys might show up and get in fist fights with them. And there was a lot of violence. And people looking back on this in later years pointed out that much of the violence wasn't caused by the strikers. It was caused by the strike breakers who were brought in by mine management.
So, Troy Henderson, it's Christmas time. It has been a rough few months since the strike started in the summer. And miners and their families go to the Italian Hall for a Christmas party sponsored by the Ladies Auxiliary of the Western Federation of Miners. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, the Western Federation of Miners planned this party, and it was primarily for children of striking miners. You know, and these families had limited income at that time since they were not getting their usual wages because they were taking part in the strike. So hundreds of children celebrated Christmas on the second floor of the Italian Hall in Calumet. And as the party was winding down a little bit later in the afternoon, somebody yelled fire, sending the panicked children and families to the exit, which was the only exit, down a narrow stairway. At some point toward the bottom, somebody tripped, and it began to create a backlog of people wanting to get out. The more people that piled on, the more force it put on the people on the bottom. And 73 people, the majority of them children, were crushed to death in that stairway. And there was actually no fire.
There was actually no fire. And I think a modern day thing that people may remember is on a smaller scale, but terrible. The idea of a crushing force of a crowd was that Who concert in Cincinnati when everybody tried to crush in to get inside a door. And they had, I think, 13. Not as bad, but that idea of the force of a crowd, that is really terrifying, isn't it, Steve?
Remember, you know, what we're talking about here is people getting crushed in a stampede, and they're going down an extremely steep flight of stairs, and there were people pushing from behind, but also the crowd is largely children. And as you pointed out at the Who concert, that was on level ground. That was, you know, people pushing forward. And when you add, you know, into the mix of all these little kids and trying to get down a stairway, it just became catastrophic. And, you know, the pileup in the stairway actually took quite some time to clear, and they couldn't even clear it from underneath. They had to have rescuers come in. There was a fire escape on the side of the building, and they went up the fire escape and came around inside and had to undo this, you know, tangle of bodies from the top. And, you know, as they pulled people out of the stairway, they realized that there was, you know, dozens and dozens of people dead. Vast majority of them were, in fact, children.
And this, Steve, became a source for conspiracy theories. What are some of the more popular theories about what happened then?
Well, a lot of witnesses said they saw the guy come in from outside and yell fire and then, you know, take off. So it wasn't a person inside the hall. There was no fire. So it sounds like somebody came in specifically to break the party up. And the most obvious culprits were strikebreakers, because strikebreakers had been disrupting union activities all year long. And so a strikebreaker would have thought, hey, I can go and break up this party and I won't get in trouble for it. I believe it was a strikebreaker who ran into the party and yelled fire to break the party up. And in my research, I came across the story of a guy named Edward Manley, who was a strikebreaker, who was mysteriously pulled out of the pile of the people on the stairs. And what was a strikebreaker doing in that pile? And I explain in much more detail in my book, but that guy had no reason to be there. And he was very quickly spirited away from the catastrophe as they cleaned it up. And he disappears from the story. And I honestly think that mine management, when they heard that this guy had done this, said, you know something, get this guy out of town. We'll never speak of him again. And the guy disappears from the story. But I'm convinced that he was the man who cried fire. Now, I don't think he intended to kill people, but he did make a reckless act that resulted in the deaths of others. And as an attorney, I can tell you that's against the law. So I think that most people who study this, that, yeah, it was a guy who tried to break the party up and it killed people. But unfortunately, there's still people in the community to this day who will argue with you about it and say, no, it was simply a tragic accident. And I think some people can't wrap their head around the idea that someone would intentionally cause a disruption, killing children on Christmas Eve at a Christmas party. That is one of the most striking things about the story, is when it happened and who the victims are.
And Troy Henderson, you are a Youper. How is this disaster remembered in the Upper Peninsula?
Well, this disaster is well known in the UP, and it's preserved through stories, you know, people telling stories who were impacted by this event. For this tragedy, I like to draw kind of a comparison to an iron mine cave-in at Barnes Hecker, which killed 51 miners and actually entombed most of them underground, and they're still in that mine. This happened in 1926, and it's similar in the sense that there's kind of an unsettled feeling, a lack of closure to the event and to the tragedy. So today, you know, if you go to Calumet, the building is now gone. It eventually fell into disrepair and was demolished in 1984. But the stone arch of Lake Superior sandstone that framed that stairway was preserved and is now on the spot where that building was, and a monument marks the tragedy today.
It's a sobering and very, very sad, sad moment in Michigan history. And you've taken us there very brilliantly, historian Troy Henderson with the Michigan History Center, and Steve Leto, attorney and author of Death's Door, The Truth Behind Michigan's Largest Mass Murder. I want to thank both of you for being with us for this edition of Michigan History and taking us to Calumet, Christmas Eve, 1913.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Happy to be here.